and that half of ambassadors in the first cohort are current students.
So we wanted to have our ambassadors work with their native student centers or organizations on their campus and just help bring NAJS's voice into a bigger light.
The group is funded by private donations and therefore won't be directly impacted by cuts from the Trump administration. Meanwhile, the Native American Rights Fund in March sued the U.S. Interior Department and the Office of Indian Affairs over the federal administration's cuts to the Bureau of Indian Education. O'Shea Burden Ground comes from the Great Upsalaka Nation and will graduate this spring from the University of Montana. He first used Jumpstart funding to attend a conference. Now, as an ambassador, Burden Ground encourages future Indigenous leaders to take advantage of educational opportunities.
There are a lot of opportunities out there for education and leadership development, and I wouldn't hesitate to jump on any one of those opportunities that is provided to you.
I'm Kathleen Shannon.
Alaska already imports most of its food, but for many tribes in rural areas, cuts to federal grants and staff by the Trump administration could make food security even tougher, including for farmers and reindeer herders.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 3rd.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158.
Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem.
The producer is Annette Newell and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth up next.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. New U.S. minerals deal with Ukraine amounts to reparations. Russia rejects Trump's Ukraine plan. And Signalgate, a nightmare for the Trump team. First, the new U.S. minerals deal with Ukraine amounts to reparations. The Telegraph has obtained a copy of the latest version of Trump's minerals deal with Ukraine, a deal President Zelensky has not yet agreed to sign. As the Telegraph puts it, the deal leaves little doubt that Mr. Trump's chief objective is to incorporate Ukraine as a province of America's oil, gas, and resource industries. The latest U.S. proposal states that the U.S.-Ukraine Reconstruction Investment Fund will control Ukraine's critical minerals or other minerals, oil, natural gas, including liquefied natural gas, fuels or other hydrocarbons, and other extractable materials. All critical materials listed in the U.S. Energy Act are covered, including both rare earths and 50 other minerals, such as lithium, titanium, and so on. The U.S. will control all the transport, refining, and processing facilities related to these resources. Ukraine will receive 50% of the royalties, but only after it has paid off $100 billion in U.S. aid. The U.S. does not make any investment in this project, nor provide Ukraine with any security assurances. The Trump administration argues that the agreement ensures that Russia will not attack Ukraine again. Even if that might prove true, the agreement represents treatment of Ukraine as the aggressor and Russia as the victim. Imagine if the U.S. after World War II had presented the British with a bill for military support. Russia rejects Trump's Ukraine plan. The president says he's PO'd with Vladimir Putin, telling NBC News that he'll impose more sanctions on Moscow if it doesn't cooperate on negotiations to end the war in Ukraine. His upset is supposedly over Putin's wanting a change of leadership in Ukraine, which Trump says would delay a war settlement. Here's a reminder, it was Trump who first raised the issue of Zelensky needing to conduct an election. If Russia and I are unable to make a deal on stopping the bloodshed in Ukraine, says Trump, and if I think it was Russia's fault, which it might not be, but if I think it was Russia's fault, I'm going to put secondary tariffs on oil, all oil coming out of Russia. Well, here's his chance. Sergei Ryabkov, an advisor to Putin, said 2 days ago, quote, "We take the models and solutions proposed by the Americans very seriously, but we can't accept it all in its current form." Ryabkov repeated the Kremlin line that a war settlement requires addressing its root causes, which, as I've pointed out previously, means essentially denying that Ukraine is a legitimate country. Signalgate, a nightmare for the Trump team. The exceptional incompetence of the Trump national security team was on full display with the revelation that a chat on the commercial app Signal about a bombing mission against the Houthis in Yemen had inadvertently brought the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine, Jeffrey Goldberg, into what was clearly a classified discussion. There are several important details about this bombshell event that are worth highlighting. First, the president was not present. He left it to subordinates to decide on the mission. Second, the chief person responsible for allowing the chat to go public is Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who violated the Pentagon's own advisory on not using Signal for classified communications. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz reportedly was on the verge of being fired for inviting Jeffrey Goldberg into the conversation. Third, everyone involved, as well as Trump, is in denial about how it happened and why it happened, and whether or not the chat revealed classified information, and who might be responsible, and whether it was even important. Fourth, when in doubt, shift the blame. Trump said he knew nothing about the matter, but attacked the journalist and The Atlantic. Hegseth said the story was a hoax, attacked Goldberg as a, quote, deceitful and highly discredited journalist. In Trump's first term, playing fast and loose with classified information was a serious problem. Trump famously revealed Israeli secrets to the Russians in one such incident. And of course, there's Trump's hiding of classified documents that he illegally took from the White House. So this incident was perfectly predictable. You can bet that foreign governments allied with the United States are paying attention to such carelessness. In other news, Trump's retreat from foreign aid to poor countries is revealed. A 281-page spreadsheet that the U.S. Agency for International Development sent to Congress listed the foreign aid projects it plans to continue and, mostly, terminate. The New York Times obtained a copy of the spreadsheet and other documents describing the plans. The documents provide a sweeping overview of the extraordinary scale of the administration's retreat from a half-century-long effort to lead the fight against infectious diseases that kill millions of people annually. Only a handful of more than 6,000 USAID employees are still on active duty. In all, the administration has decided to continue 898 USAID projects and end 5,341. It says the remaining programs are worth up to $78 billion, but only $8.3 billion of that is unobligated funds, money still available to disperse and covering several years into the future. The administration is now formally seeking the elimination of USAID, but a court battle is ongoing. Next, fears of foreign interference in Canada's upcoming elections. Interference by India has already rocked the early days of Canada's federal election, with officials warning that sophisticated efforts from other hostile nations are expected in the coming weeks. As Canadians prepare to cast ballots on April 28th, senior officials say that India, China, Pakistan, and Iran are all expected to make efforts to subvert the national vote through increasingly sophisticated disinformation campaigns. The use of artificial intelligence tools is likely to figure prominently in efforts to deceive voters and sway diaspora groups. Earlier this year, a landmark inquiry into foreign interference found that information manipulation is the biggest risk to democratic institutions. More seizures of foreign students by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. In what amounts to a kidnapping, partly masked ICE agents in unmarked cars seized a Tufts University graduate student from Turkey, Rümeysa Öztürk, off the street and moved her to a detention center in Louisiana, just as they did Mahmoud Khalil at Columbia. Like the other students whose visas were canceled by the administration, Öztürk was guilty of nothing more than political speech in favor of Hamas. CNN reports that the seizure, quote, appeared to violate a federal court order which directed the Department of Homeland Security and ICE to give the court 48 hours notice before attempting to take her out of Massachusetts. After Öztürk's transfer to Louisiana emerged from the online locator, the federal judge ordered DHS and ICE to respond to an emergency request in court by March 27th. This is what happens in a dictatorship. The Council on American-Islamic Relations, an advocacy group, said in a statement, quote, "We unequivocally condemn the abduction of a young Muslim hijab-wearing scholar by masked federal agents in broad daylight. This alarming act of repression is a direct assault on free speech and academic freedom." Louisiana has become known as Detention Alley since it houses ICE courts and jails where migrants languish while awaiting disposition of their cases. A Pentagon strategy paper right out of Project 2025. In another sign that Russia is no longer an adversary and Europe is on its own, a secret Pentagon strategic guidance memo has been leaked showing that a Chinese invasion of Taiwan is the primary concern. China is the department's sole pacing threat, and denial of a Chinese fait accompli seizure of Taiwan while simultaneously defending the U.S. homeland is the department's sole pacing scenario, says the memo. The report mirrors the Project 2025 recommendations. No other war scenario is mentioned in the document. To the contrary, the memo says the U.S. will, quote, assume risk in other theaters, meaning the Middle East, Europe, and elsewhere in Asia. What makes this strategic planning so questionable is that at no time since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022 has China shown any preparation for invading Taiwan, though it has conducted harassing maneuvers around the island to counter any move toward independence by Taiwan. Sweden boasts of getting immigrants to leave. Lydia Polgren, an opinion columnist for the New York Times, reports that for the first time, more people are leaving Sweden than arriving. One reason is that the center-right government, supported by anti-immigrant forces, is giving immigrants $34,000 to depart. The government is otherwise making Sweden inhospitable to migrants, such as by reducing grants of asylum. This, says Polgren, quote, in a country that had long celebrated its status as a refuge for people fleeing war and repression. Sweden, she writes, has gone from safe haven to heavily fortified citadel. She points out, however, that the underlying problem in Sweden is that the welfare state has shriveled over the years, straining the economy and its famous social welfare network, and creating backlash against the roughly 20% of the population that is now immigrant. Two big losses for far-right money. A court gave Elon Musk the green light in Wisconsin to buy votes in last night's state Supreme Court election. He invested about $26 million of his own money and gave $1 million and other monetary rewards to voters, all of which flatly failed. And in France, far-right leader Marine Le Pen was banned from running for public office for 5 years after being convicted on Monday of embezzlement. That should keep her out of the 2027 presidential race, where she has been the front runner in polls. The Trump tariffs on autos. As I speak, we're awaiting the latest announcement from Trump of the next round of tariffs. But in the meantime, he issued an executive order that all vehicles imported into the U.S. will now be subject to a 25% tariff. Trump said the tariffs are permanent. Mark Carney, Canada's prime minister, called the tariffs, quote, a direct attack on Canadian auto workers. He promised an auto workers union that he would create a $2 billion strategic response fund to boost Canada's auto sector and protect manufacturing jobs. President Trump is at it again. Ontario's Conservative Premier Doug Ford wrote on X, his 25% tariffs on cars and light trucks will do nothing more than increase costs for hardworking American families. U.S. markets are already on the decline as the president causes more chaos and uncertainty. He's putting American jobs at risk. I've spoken with Prime Minister Carney. We agree Canada needs to stand firm, strong, and united. I fully support the federal government preparing retaliatory tariffs to show that we'll never back down. The pressure is on Japanese and Korean politicians to shield their auto workers from the impact of the tariffs. China's Vice Premier He Lifeng met with the U.S. Trade Representative in Beijing and told him that China would be imposing reciprocal tariffs on U.S. goods. Finally, two updates. The first one from Greenland. On March 28th, Vice President J.G. Vance joined his wife and National Security Advisor Mike Waltz in visiting where they are least wanted, Greenland. Because of local opposition to being scouted for potential takeover, the three limited their visit to a remote U.S. base. The Times reported that, quote, during Mr. Vance's visit, he plans to stress the importance of security infrastructure in Greenland. Considering that he did nothing but freeze in -3-degree weather, I wonder who he's going to stress to. And in Israel, Shin Bet and the Attorney General are currently investigating members of Netanyahu's inner circle over alleged ties between them and Qatar as part of a probe of payments to Netanyahu by Qatar to ensure Hamas rule in Gaza. Two former Netanyahu aides were arrested in connection with the investigation. The ruling Likud party railed against fabricated investigations, alleging that the Attorney General's office and Shin Bet Security Service were working to, quote, carry out a coup d'etat through arrest warrants. Likud charges that the arrests were intended to prevent the removal of Shin Bet's head, whom Netanyahu fired, but remains on the job while the Israeli Supreme Court reviews the firing. Likud has not denied that payments were made, and Netanyahu himself has been called in for questioning. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Onyx. Starting Friday, there will be an exhibition where a group of 50 LGBTQIA artists and creatives will be putting on a couple of shows. Holding Our Own and Shift Work are the names of these shows. It will be held April 4th through May 10th at Multnomah Arts Center. I got the chance to talk to one of the curators, Megan Hatch. You are the curator for two upcoming shows at the Multnomah Arts Center. What are those?
We have two gallery spaces here. They're called the Front and Center Galleries at the Multnomah Arts Center. And the two shows, so in our front gallery is a group show called Holding Our Own, which is a collection of work by 11 LGBTQIA2S+ ceramic artists and potters. And that was curated by Lux Harris and myself. In our center gallery, we have a show called Shift Work, Queer Artists Navigating Tectonic Times. It's a mouthful. This show has work by over 40 LGBTQIA2S+ artists, and it was curated by Pablo Cazares and myself.
Could you tell me more about being a gallerist and what that work looks like?
That work shifts a bit according to where you're doing it, but right here in a community center, it really means working with the community, working with the artists in our community to help them create shows, to help them show their work, and working with the wider public in giving them access to art, to giving them access to shows. So in the sort of day-to-day of my job, it means talking with a lot of people and working with a lot of people to bring art into our daily life more and more.
What was the process of putting these events together like?
So it was a wonderful process. It's one of my favorite things about working here is the way that I get to work with so many different people. These shows really came out of an idea that sparked last summer when we were reviewing applications for our large call for art. So every year we put out a call for art, and I review those applications with two artist curators from the community. And those artist curators steer the shows that happen here. In this case, we had a group of artists who were all applying independently whose work was really speaking to each other. They all happened to identify as queer and trans. And we really saw an opportunity to build a show around their work. And so we have four, and I'm speaking about our shift work show, we have Areem Rose, Tommy Bruce, Ami Patel, Zephyr Kim, and Robert Sumner as our featured artists. So they have multiple pieces in this show. And then with Pablo, my co-curator, you know, we worked with the artists to choose which pieces would be in the show. And then we also created a communal art piece. So it's a large piece that is called We Take Care of Us. And it is photographs printed 5 inch square from over 40 different artists in the region. And those artists all submitted work that is speaking to what they're feeling or feeling for right now in this moment in our country as queer people, as trans people. And so these pieces are installed all together, 5 inch squares, interspersed with 5 inch mirrors. So we're really inviting the viewer into that process, into the we. There's no other here. What Pablo and I are saying. And the individual pieces, so those 5 inch photographs, are going to be for sale. And the sale of those photographs goes to benefit PAIR, which is another community-based organization here in town, another really long-standing organization working with unhoused youth. Many of those youth across the country, many of those youth, a disproportionate number of unhoused youth are queer and trans. And so it's really the work itself is generating the care that is so much a heart of the queer and trans community, currently and historically. And it will be in our future as well.
What would you want people to take away from these shows?
So both of these shows are asking questions. They're really about the questions that LGBTQIA+ folks are asking of themselves and of each other right now. And it's how do we navigate during these times when the ground is shifting underneath our feet and when hatred is being increasingly legislated? And part of the answer is in the shows themselves, and that's why I'd really encourage people to come down and see these shows. You know, it's free to come into the center. You can come in anytime the center is open to see the work. And what people will find is a whole bunch of beauty and a whole bunch of joy and a lot of grief and some anger and the full human experience, right? And these questions that I'm referring to is like, how do we navigate during this time? How do we find each other and take care of each other? These are questions that are being asked by so many different people. These aren't questions that are just held by queer and trans folks. So this show, both of these shows are really an invitation into the question and an invitation into finding the collective answer. We're going to have an opening reception on April 10th, that's next Thursday, from 6 to 8 p.m. That's a reception for both shows. Many of the artists will be here. We're going to have an artist talk on April 18th from 1 to 2:30 in the afternoon, and that's going to happen via Zoom so more people can participate. And folks will need to sign up for that, but it's free. It's just they need to sign up to get the Zoom link. And they can do that via our website, which is www.multnomahartcenter.org. And then, and I'm really excited about this. Well, I'm excited about all of it, but I'm really excited about the event that we have on April 26th from 2 to 4 p.m. It's called Fractals, a QT poetry reading. Q and T in this case stands for queer and trans. This I had the honor to organize with Ami Patel, who is a local writer who is held in high esteem by many. And she will be reading along with 9 other queer and trans writers. They'll be doing a reading, and that will occur here at the Multnomah Arts Center in our auditorium. That is also free and open to the public. No sign up is required. You can just come on in. There's a lot going on here, both in the galleries and around the galleries. And these shows will be up. They open on April 4th, and they'll be up through May 10th.
So how long has this idea been in play?
So we've been working on these shows off and on since last summer. So August, we started meeting with the featured artists. In December, Pablo and I really, and Lux and I really started digging in to finalize the details of these shows. And the last several weeks have been just a delicious push towards the finish line of getting the art on the walls.
What made you want to work with Pear?
Pear is doing such great work and such necessary work and has been doing it for so long that, you know, when we were looking for, when Pablo and I were thinking about ways to expand the impact of this show beyond the walls of the gallery, right? And beyond the people who come into the gallery, this was really an opportunity to connect, right? And to share the care that we're talking about, that collective care that is so much at the heart of the queer community. And Pear immediately sprung to mind as being another local organization, as working with folks who need the support, and it was just a perfect tie-in. They, Kanani Miyamoto is a wonderful artist and curator here in town, and also runs the arts programming for Pear, and she's just been doing great work, really creative work with the community there. So it was just it was a really natural pairing. It just sort of clicked into place. So we're really excited about that as well.
Will there be a chance for people to purchase pieces?
Absolutely. What a great question. Thank you for that. Yes. Almost all of the work, not all of it, but almost all of the work in these two shows is for sale. The Multnomah Arts Center, like I said, is a community arts center, and we set up the sales so that they benefit the artists more than you might find elsewhere. So the proceeds of the sales are split. 65% goes to the artists who make the work. 35% goes to our sister nonprofit organization called the Multnomah Arts Center Association. And that association, that nonprofit, really works with us to expand access to all the programming that happens here at the Arts Center, which includes classes and all the different art forms, and classes for littles all the way through elders. So they're using that 35% for scholarships. They're using that to help us acquire equipment for the art classes. They're helping us to keep the lights on in the gallery. So when people purchase work, it is supporting the artists directly, which is so important. Our world needs artists, and artists need to be able to pay their bills. And it's also going to support the arts in our community and access for everyone to those forms of art.
What do you wish people knew about this exhibition or your work in general?
I've spoken quite a bit about the importance of these two shows and these two shows in this time and this place. I think it's also a really wonderful opportunity for people who haven't been to the Multnomah Arts Center yet to learn more about what's here, because there's such a richness of resource in this building, and our staff go out into the community and work, bring art and art making out into the community. And it's also an opportunity for the community to come here as well and see and get inspired by the sounds of the tap dancing that's happening down the hall, or the choir that's practicing across the hall, or see the enormous room full of looms and weaving, and take a look at all of the class opportunities here to come and learn and experiment and explore and connect with art and with each other and with themselves. So that would be my hope, is that people are inspired. People are inspired to care for each other, and people are inspired to create together.
Wonderful. Where can people find this exhibition?
So anybody can go to our website, which is www.multnomahartscenter.org. And there they'll find information about everything that's happening in the Arts Center, including our in our galleries. And the Arts Center is located in Southwest Portland. Our address is 7688 Southwest Capitol Highway. We're right in Multnomah Village.
That was a conversation with Megan Hatch, curator of the upcoming exhibition. The event is going to be on April 4th through May 10th. More information can be found at the Multnomah Arts Center website at www.multnomahartscenter.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Onyx.
I'm Sequoia Ezekwe for Ear to the Streets of Portland on the best community radio station on the planet, KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland.